It's All About Food with Karen Hartglass, Wednesdays at 3 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network.
Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. Good afternoon. Oh, gosh, you know my favorite subject, food. I love talking about food, delicious food, beautiful food, food that affects our health, and that can be in a positive way and a not-so-positive way, food that impacts our environment and all life on Earth. I'm always looking into all different things that have to do with food, and there are some places I go to for information that is helpful to me, and one of the sources that I really rely on is Dr. Michael Greger as a person, and his websites are loaded with really wonderful information. And he is our guest today. He's a physician, author, and internationally recognized professional speaker on a number of important public health issues. Dr. Greger has lectured at the Conference on World Affairs, the National Institutes of Health, and the International Bird Flu Summit, among countless other symposia and institutions. Testified before Congress and was invited as an expert witness in defense of Oprah Winfrey at the infamous meat defamation trial. Currently, Dr. Greger proudly serves as the Director of Public Health and Animal Agriculture at the Humane Society of the United States. And there's so much more to know about Dr. Greger. He's an author of several books, including Bird Flu, A Virus of Our Own Hatching, and Carbophobia, The Scary Truth Behind America's Low-Carb Craze. And you can find out more about him at his newest website, nutritionfacts.org. Welcome, Dr. Michael Greger. Woo!
Thank you so much.
Okay. Big applause. How are you doing?
Good.
What are you doing?
Well, this website has taken over my life. Started this summer, this nutritionfacts.org. I've put all my nutrition work over all the years up online. And so it's the first kind of non-commercial science-based website to provide, you know, free daily updates on the latest in nutrition research.
Well, we definitely need it. Definitely need it. We're all trying, those who are doing this sort of work, trying to get information out there because we're all being smothered by all kinds of false information, confusing information, junk, stuff that is killing us, our families, our environment. Your information is a lifeline.
Well, I mean, there are very powerful industry interests that whose best interest is to keep us confused about nutrition. But the surprisingly consistent story emerges over the last few decades in terms of what's the best to eat. I try to stay on top of that research and post a new video every day to complement the hundreds of videos already there on over 1,000 topics. It's really something I'm very excited about and glad to be able to give it to the world.
Do you have any favorites that you've put up so far?
Oh, God, lots of favorites. In fact, I'm sometimes surprised on what other people's favorites are not necessarily my favorites, but what I'm learning more and more what people are interested in. Some things I think people would be interested in, no one looks at. Other people love some things.
Yep.
God, they love the poop studies.
Okay.
Every time I talk about bowel movements, some of the most kind of highly rated, most watched things. You know, and here I am talking about reversing heart disease, our number one killer, saving hundreds of thousands of lives, but they want to look at the bowel movements.
Yeah, it's funny. Well, as you know, when people change their diet, the first thing they start talking about is their poop.
I guess that's, yeah. Well, I mean, and there is some really good, interesting new science, and that I always like to hit. But now I go out of my way to look for those studies, knowing that they're popular.
Right. Well, so, and then I guess after poop is probably gas.
Poop and death. sudden cardiac death, definitely people are interested in, as well they should be. You know, most people realize that, you know, the number one killer of both men and women every year for nearly 100 years is heart disease. But what people may not realize is that the number one killer is not just heart disease, it's actually sudden cardiac death, which is kind of unexplained death from cardiac causes within 1 hour of one's first symptoms in someone without any previous known condition. So these are people that don't know they have heart disease, and their first symptom is their last and occurs not years before they die, but literally minutes before they die. So we can't wait to start eating healthier somewhere down the road. We need to start eating healthier today, tonight.
That's really scary, actually, when, you know, there's a lot of diseases out there, and some of us, when we're diagnosed with them, choose to make changes in our lives to get healthier, but when you have sudden heart attack death, it's over, game's over, nothing you can do.
You know, I mean, even if, you know, here we are in our last hour on this earth in agony, even if the paramedics, you know, take away our chicken wings or refuse to stop at our favorite fast food joint on the way to the hospital, it may just be too late. We need to start changing our diet. And, you know, these are people in their 30s, 40s, 50s dying from these heart attacks. You know, one moment we can be with our family feeling fine, and an hour later be gone forever. So,
yeah, well, that information really needs to get out there. And certainly we're hearing more information about how heart disease is reversible and preventable, but we're not hearing it enough. Now, you talk sometimes about doctors going through medical school and the training they get on nutrition. I was just having lunch with an old high school friend who's a doctor today, and it was really insightful to me to just talk to a regular mainstream doctor and his attitude about nutrition and health. And one of the things that I got out of it was that the patients don't want the information about health and nutrition, and so the doctors might mention it really quickly before prescribing pills. I don't believe that.
Not only might they, when they say just barely mention, is true. There's actually, I just profiled a study of thousands of clinical visits of over 100 family physicians, and they calculated, you know, how much time they talked about what, and the average amount of nutrition advice during a visit, 10 seconds. Less than 10 seconds. And so, I mean, you know, and, but that's what, you know, that's what doctors say. Doctors say, oh, well, I don't tell my patients to stop smoking because they don't want to hear it. A doctor's job isn't to tell people what they want to hear. A doctor's job is to tell people what they need to hear. And what they need to hear is these public health messages, which may save their lives and save the lives of their families.
Well, I believe that. And, you know, when we're fighting with all the media information, misinformation that we're getting, I'm not going to depend only on my medical doctors, but they need to be giving the right information and stressing it. I had a fight about a cardiologist I went to see last year just to get some regular checkup, and I kept saying, you know, why are you focusing on statins? Why aren't you focusing on nutrition? And he brings out a list of the things he talks about with people with heart disease, and the first thing on the list is eat more fruits and vegetables. But, you know, he says people don't want to hear it, and you're right. The doctors need to tell people what they need, not what they want to hear.
And it's true. And you're lucky that the doctor even says that much. You know, there's a big push now to get more, you know, get doctors, you know, to talk to their patients more about nutrition. But until they know more about nutrition, maybe we don't want them talking about nutrition. You know, Atkins was a cardiologist. Do we want him to, you know, when he was alive, you know, we wouldn't want him to spend more time telling people about nutrition. And so that's a real kind of fundamental thing we need to change about medical education. Currently, only about a quarter of medical schools have a single required course in nutrition. And that hasn't changed in nearly 30 years, 25 years less. So from 1982, but essentially no change in nutrition education. And when we actually survey, when we test nutrition, basic nutrition of information of doctors, for example, on nutrition and heart disease, the most important thing they should know, our number one killer, they fail. On average, 64% correct. I actually go through some of the test scores. So, doctors fail when it comes to their knowledge of nutrition. So not only do they, so they need to learn more in medical school, they need to get more continuing medical education once they're out.
And the education shouldn't come from pharmaceutical companies, which is where they get a lot of their information from.
That's certainly, that's who pays, he who pays the piper gets to choose the tune. There's a term called drug lunch. Drug lunches. In medical school, they get taken out to lunch, not by the broccoli lobby, not by, the Cabbage Association, right? But they'll get taken out by, by all the pharmaceutical companies. And given free gifts and free vacations and all sorts of things because, they know that it actually changes people's prescribing habits. They don't do it out of the goodness of their heart. They do it because they know they can, that the medical school minds are malleable. Unfortunately, that's, if you just learn about drugs, if you're just tested on drugs and surgery, that's what you're going to study for on the exams and on the boards, and that's what you're going to know when you get out. Thankfully, there's this revolution in medicine happening now with lifestyle medicine taking the forefront. The CNN documentary, Last Heart Attack, bringing to light as if it was some new discovery.
As if it was new.
Right? They talked about, Esselstyn and Ornis. Both those doctors have been publishing on reversing heart disease without drugs, without surgery, for decades, literally decades.
Yeah.
And yet now it's like some new thing. But, hey, better late than never.
For those who are still alive and can do something about it,
exactly,
absolutely.
That haven't died. Hundreds of thousands have already died, and we have the miracle cure. We've had it for decades, since at least 1990 when Dr. Dean Ornish published his first paper proving reversal of heart disease without drugs and surgery. Since then, totally unnecessary deaths by the hundreds of thousands, and it didn't need to happen.
What I like to do is make things really simple and talk to people how important it is to eat whole, fresh, plant-based foods, fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, raw nuts and seeds. Keep it really simple. Don't worry about counting this and that. You go into a lot of detail with different foods and the nutrients they have, the specific properties that they have, what they can do, if they're good for you, if they're not good for you, which is great. I'm a big greens person. I love my dark leafy greens. I have green juice every day. Can't eat enough greens. But there are some greens that may not be as good as others. And I know you talk about the blue-green algae, spirulina, chlorella. Can you talk about them?
Sure. The healthiest dark green leafy vegetables are the cruciferous family, the brassicas, the kind of cabbage family vegetables, like the collards and kale and bok choy and broccoli, because they have this family of phytonutrients that actually boost your liver's ability to detoxify carcinogens. Absolutely amazing. So it's not just kind of your mom saying eat your greens. There's actually this wonderful science showing how it kind of boosts your body's ability to prevent and fight cancer, as well as a host of other things. And so I encourage people to eat as many dark green leafies as they can possibly stuff in their face. There are, however, these microscopic dark green leafies. They aren't technically vegetables. They're in a whole different kind of kingdom biologically. But there are concerns about blue-green algae and spirulina. Not about chlorella, but about those former two, for a variety of reasons. They can periodically produce toxins, both neurotoxins, muscle toxins, and so because you don't know if the batch that's on the shelf has these toxins, I would encourage people to stay away from blue-green algae and spirulina, although those toxins are not found in chlorella, which is another kind of unicellular algae species.
Okay, that's good to know. So it's batch-related somehow.
And they don't test every batch. That's the problem. It's prohibitively expensive. And so it's not like you can say, this type of algae is safe or not safe. It's safe some of the time and not safe other of the time. It for some reasons we don't know, the algae turns on and off toxin production. And so it's not like species related. You can't just get the good algae.
Right.
That same algae, which was fine yesterday, may be producing toxins today, and unfortunately it's too expensive to test every batch. And so I encourage people, and look, it's cheaper anyway to go out and buy kale. And so go to your farmer's market rather than the supplement aisle in your health food store.
Yay! I love kale. I just had a big kale salad.
Mm.
And a lovely green juice. One more on the green thing. Can we talk just a little bit about oxalic acid?
Sure. Basically only three grains that are high in oxalates: spinach, Swiss chard, and beet greens. And they're wonderful foods, and I encourage people to eat them, but they're just not great sources of, for example, calcium, because these oxalates inhibit the mineral absorption, kind of bind up their own calcium. Now, you can take spinach and put it in a blender with kale, and the oxalic acid in the spinach won't touch the calcium that's in the kale. It just binds up its own calcium, so it's just relatively unavailable. However, spinach has all sorts of other wonderful things in it, lutein, which is good, the kind of a critical eyesight-saving nutrient, but so do the other greens as well. So if you're going to do greens and you really don't care which one, I encourage people to eat the lower oxalate greens, because you can get it. It's a great way to get your calcium for the day. But all dark green leafies are wonderful.
That's wild that the spinach oxalate doesn't touch the kale calcium.
Nope, so you can make a nice spinach kale pesto or something, and needn't worry that somehow it would interfere with the absorption of the calcium that's already there in the kale.
I'm very glad to. Very good to know that. The thing is, for me, the spinach, Swiss chard, and beet greens, they all have a kind of metallic taste to them to me.
There are other conditions that, so for people who have oxalate kidney stones, may want to decrease their oxalate consumption and do a whole bunch of other things.
Yeah, the thing is, with spinach, people, when they're getting into the green leafy world, that's usually the one that they go to first, and having it every day isn't a good idea unless they're getting the other ones.
I wouldn't eat it in huge amounts, particularly if you're susceptible to kidney stones, gout, a few other things.
Okay, so you have a blog, and I was looking over it, and you had this one blog where you were inviting people to pick the best of in these all different categories. And I was just kind of like, I wonder what the best of is, and I don't know if you've announced any of those results, or that's an ongoing thing where people have to write in.
Oh, well, no, if you click on the links, you can watch the videos.
Oh, okay.
Right? Each question is a link to the video where you can actually watch to get the answer. But, we've got about 30 winners who got all their right answers.
Really?
And sent them out free DVDs, and actually the Volume 7, the next DVD, coming out next month, all proceeds of which, of course, go to charity. And all the videos from all the DVDs are up online, free for viewing for everyone, nutritionfacts.org.
Well, I guess I'm going to have to watch all of them. Where am I going to find the time? But so can I just ask you one of them? Is there really one apple that's better than all the rest?
Oh, well, certainly. Well, in terms of antioxidant content, there was a study that actually looked at 21 different varieties of apples, which includes most of the ones that people find in stores. And, yeah, absolutely. It's, well, I mean, crab apples was number one.
Can we eat crab apples?
You can, yeah, and they're actually very, very healthy for you, and particularly because they have such a high skin-to-volume ratio because they're so much smaller, and the skin is really the healthiest part. So for a variety of reasons, crab apples are the best. But, of course, that's not something you can buy in a store. The healthiest kind of apple that you can kind of buy in a store is Ida Red, actually. Has the kind of highest antioxidant content. But if you compare that to, for example, one of the lowest, something like a Fuji, it's at most kind of 2-to-1. So eating, one Ida Red is the equivalent of eating two Fujis. But look, if you like Fuji apples or that's what's available, fine, eat two.
Right.
Great.
That's right. I've never seen an Ida Red.
The healthiest apple is the one you're going to eat the most of.
That's right. Does the Ida Red have a thicker skin?
No. There's just the skin is just packed with quercetin and all these other wonderful apple antioxidants.
And so let's make a commercial now for organic food, because if you want to eat the skin of the apple to get all that goodness in it, you're going to want your apple to be organic.
Yeah, rinsing apples under running water only gets the conventional apples only gets off about 15% of the pesticides. And I would encourage people to indeed rinse their apples, but whereas if you peel the apple, then you can get rid of about 85% of the pesticides, but then you're getting rid of almost all the nutrition. So I encourage people, indeed, buy organics. You can eat the skin. But even if you only, for whatever reason, are restricted to conventional apples, the benefits still outweigh the risks, right? Mm. So why get any risks? Choose organic.
Choose organic. And apples are one of the foods now that's pretty easy to find organic. That's reasonably priced. In fact, here in New York City, I've seen conventional apples just as expensive as organic apples. Yeah. It's the same.
Right. And yeah, and 'tis the season. You can go to a kind of pick your own if you're not too urban.
That's right. Well, yeah, we have lots of great farms here in New York, and this is the season. Okay, so then another one in your which is the best of that I was kind of curious about were the one about mushrooms.
Mm.
And so you had two questions about mushrooms, but you didn't include some mushrooms that I knew were good for cancer. Now, they may not be the kind you want to saute up, but they're mushrooms. Is there a reason why you left out maitake and reishi and coriolis?
Right. There are medicinal mushrooms, but I kind of, you know, so there are certainly plant foods that are kind of, I place in the medicinal category as opposed to the kind of culinary category, because they do have these kind of very powerful effects. It's not something that you would necessarily do unless you need them for a specific purpose. And so that I would put something like a maitake in a separate class as opposed to something that, you know, you would just stir fry up, although certainly you can.
Yeah, I would put maitake in the magic category.
Yes, the Journal of Magical Fungus. Yeah, I haven't quite seen that one, but and the reason it wasn't included in that study is just because it wasn't in the study. I mean, that was not something
okay.
that they looked at. What they were looking at was the ability to interfere with aromatase, which is an enzyme that breast cancer cells use to produce their own estrogen. So even if you're not taking an extra estrogen like Premarin and all these other bad things, or eating meat, dairy, the breast cancer cells develop this kind of nefarious strategy to produce their own estrogen using this enzyme. And there's all sorts of chemotherapy drugs used, but of course by the time you need chemotherapy it's a little late. But there are these vegetables that are found to block this enzyme. And the most important one were mushrooms, indeed.
I've got mushrooms on my mind because last week I talked to a guy who has a book out about mushrooms, health and longevity, and so I was reminded about all the magical, wonderful properties of many of the mushrooms. And a few weeks before that, I talked to Dr. Furman, who's talking about greens and onions and mushrooms and how important they are. So I've got mushrooms on my mind.
Yes, mushrooms, that's one of the few exceptions to the, you know, white isn't good rule. You know, we don't want to eat white rice and white pasta and white bread, even white potatoes. Ideally, we would choose whole foods, but white mushrooms are incredibly powerful. So it's not actually the pigments within mushrooms that have all the wonderful properties, and that just plain white sheep, you know, button white stuffing mushrooms are beat out many of the other more exotic, expensive varieties other ones. So like cauliflower is another exception to the no white rule because it's one of those cabbage family vegetables that have those glucosinolates. But in general, we want to eat bright, colorful foods.
Let's stay on the white food theme. I was reading an article, I think it's USDA related, trying to decide what to have in the schools for kids, and there's this fight to keep French fries and pizza. It's just, oh, please, you know, can we just, anyway. I hope for a beautiful, better future. And I think we're definitely moving there, but it's slow, it's frustrating. You want to think that the government is on our side and doing the right thing, but so often they are not.
Well, I mean, the USDA has this inherent conflict of interest. I mean, if you look at their mission statement, it's promote agricultural products. At the same time, they're the ones we put in charge of offering nutrition advice for Americans. And so when it comes to eat more messaging, that's easy. Eat more fruits and vegetables, they're on board with that. But when it comes to eat less messaging, how can they do that? Because the whole point of their existence is to promote these products, like, you know, the salt industry and the sugar industry and, you know, meat, dairy, junk food, all this.
All the food that's good for us.
And so then we run into problems, and we see that with the dietary guidelines. I have a number of kind of a two-week series on, you know, how the guidelines were created and some of the inherent conflicts of interest and who are on these panels. And so, you know, in that case, one really has to look elsewhere for nutrition advice.
Yes. Okay, I want to jump around here. Can we talk about bone density a little bit?
Sure.
So there are things that work at making our bones not so healthy. There are things that work at our bones to make them healthy. And then there are things that measure our bone health, or maybe they're measuring our bone health. Can you give me some clarity on bones?
Sure. I mean, the most important thing we can do for our bones is to exercise them, is the weight-bearing exercise. You know, it's basically use it or lose it, just like our muscles. I mean, I think people think of a skeleton as, you know, the kind of just like building material, just like concrete, just not, but it's a living, breathing organ. I mean, skeleton, I mean, you know, we see the skeleton because, you know, we see it all dried up, but it is living tissue. It bleeds, it grows.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it's constantly moving and molding and reshaping itself. You know, which is the reason why, you know, broken bones can heal, because it's this vibrantly live tissue. And every time one, you know, is out walking or jogging or jumping or aerobics or anything, and you put pressure on your skeleton, it sends these little jolts of electricity, actually, which keep it healthy. Just like, you know, we need to keep our muscles healthy by doing some weight-bearing exercise. Same thing happens with our bones. And so the most important thing we can do is to exercise them. And so the current recommendation out of the Institute of Medicine is an hour of exercise every single day, 7 days a week. And for those who think, oh, my God, an hour of exercise every day? I mean, think about how we evolved over millions of years. All we did was exercise all
right.
day long. And now we're saying get one measly
right.
hour, and people are like, that's crazy. I mean, we were meant to move, and we really need to. And so that's the number one recommendation. So before I would let doctors put me on, you know, these kind of Fosamax-type drugs, these anti-osteoporosis drugs, the most important thing to do in terms of bone health is to get out there and exercise, although there's certainly dietary things one can do to augment that.
Yeah, the thing that's confusing to me is I know people that exercise quite a bit and eat well, and yet they score miserably on the bone density test, and
mm-hmm.
then the reverse is true, where people who are a little overweight don't exercise score very well on the bone density test.
Well, I mean, one of the reasons why, I mean, that's one of the advantages, surprisingly, of obesity is that even just sitting around, people who are fat exercise their bones. I mean, really, their bones have to hold up all that weight. And so actually, being skinny, being slim, is a risk factor for osteoporosis, because you're just not actually putting much pressure on your bones. It's like when you're in space and astronauts lose bone density, bone mass, because they're so light, they don't have the gravity. And similarly, skinny people walking around, they don't have the gravity pulling them down. If someone is fat, just getting up to get the remote control, all of a sudden they put some, they exercise their bones. And so that's why people with high body mass indexes can actually have healthier bones. And so it's the slimmest women who may be at most risk for osteoporosis. So it's very important for them to kind of make up for the fact that they're lighter by getting out there and moving.
Yeah, that's little slim women like me.
Ah, yes. Right,
yeah.
Exactly. You gotta move it.
Yeah, but one of the things I like to do living in New York City without a car is kind of trying to simulate what life was like back in the jungle. And I schlep everything. You know, I carry big bags of groceries and walk long distances, and that's, you know, every day.
Absolutely, right. And using stairs. I mean, these are these little things that that can significantly improve our health. And, of course, you know, not just our bone health, but our cardiovascular health as well.
Okay, Dr. Greger, we need to take a quick break, but I have so many more things to ask you. So will you stay with us?
Absolutely.
Great. We'll be right back. Hello, I'm Karen Hartglass, and you're listening to It's All About Food. I'm here with Dr. Michael Greger, who is a walking encyclopedia when it comes to nutrition facts. Just ask him anything, he knows it. Isn't that true?
I wish it were. If it were, I wouldn't have to keep doing all this research.
Where do you find all that information?
Oh, my God. Well, I am privileged to be biking distance from the National Library of Medicine here in the nation's capital. And so I'm able to kind of have access to perhaps one of the best medical libraries in the world. And there are, and so I just read through every issue of every English language nutrition journal in the world. So
wow.
You don't have to.
Now, do you use the internet, or are you physically touching some of these?
Well, I physically
journals?
Have to go there just because not all journals yet are open access, meaning you know, kind of free and available publicly online.
Mm.
Although there are a number of wonderful new nutrition journals that are going online for free. Some of the older ones, like the American, the Journal of Clinical Nutrition, probably the most prestigious nutrition journal, still requires hundreds of dollars of subscription. And but thankfully, our taxpayer money is going to some good use, and I'm able to have access to all those.
That is very good news indeed. Okay, what's going on at the Humane Society these days?
Well, we just had a case before the Supreme Court last week. After our investigation of this dairy cow slaughter plant in California led to the largest meat recall in U.S. history, this 143 million pounds of beef recall because they were, you know, taking downer cows and shoving them into the, dragging them into the federal school lunch program.
Isn't that what we always do with food that we don't like? Give it to our children?
That's what we did because they buy the cheapest meat. So California, thanks to our investigation, passed a law saying no downer animals can enter the food supply. And the National Meat Association was none too pleased by that law, wanting to squeeze every last cent of profit from these downed, disabled, sick animals. They challenged the law, and it actually went all the way to the Supreme Court. They were demanding that they be able to slaughter any animal, even animals that can't necessarily walk to slaughter, and have to be tormented to their feet or mm-hmm. dragged with chains. The opening kind of oral arguments were made. The California's Attorney General trying to defend the California law versus the National Meat Association along with the National Pork Producers Association. It's not just down cows, but down pigs is a big problem for industry. It's, of course, a big problem for the pigs, too, and
yeah.
It can be a problem for public health if these animals make it into the food supply. And so... So the Supreme Court has until June, basically, to offer an opinion, although it's not looking good.
Oh, no.
Because there's an exemption clause with the National Meat Inspection Act, which came out after Upton Sinclair, the jungle, about 100 years ago,
yep.
Hasn't changed since, basically saying that the federal law should preempt any state laws. So, you know, different states couldn't have different food safety regulations.
Right.
So there should be one over all of them. And so, and the federal law doesn't exclude, you know, downed pigs from the food supply. So how can California go beyond the federal law? They shouldn't be able to do that, according to the National Meat Association. And it's true. The law does have this preemption clause saying that, you know, states don't have the rights to pass their own stronger regulations. As much as the justices may not want to be feeding their kids downed animal meat, I'm afraid it may take legislative action. We may actually have to pass a law through Congress saying that downed animals, too sick or crippled to walk, should be excluded from the food supply.
Is this just a humane issue, or is there a health issue eating animals like this?
Well, I mean, it was brought primarily as a humane issue, but it does have public health and food safety implications. These animals, so for example, down cows, 3 times more E. coli, 015787, the kind of jack-in-the-box E. coli, the potentially deadly E. coli, three times more in the downed cows,
mm-hmm.
and of course it could be a sign of mad cow disease, though mm-hmm. that's exceedingly rare. Downed pigs, 13 times more likely to be contaminated with salmonella.
Mm.
Even if the pig is down because of a broken leg, and you say, well, they're just injured. The reason they can't walk is because they have a broken leg. It's obvious. They're still fine. The fact that they have the broken leg or on the ground need to be dragged with chains is they have more fecal contamination of their hide, of their skin. They have more manure on their skin, and there can be cross-contamination in the processing plant from the skin into the meat. Regardless of why the animal's down, wallowing in manure, these animals should not be processed for human consumption.
I read Upton Sinclair's book maybe last year. It was on my list for decades, and I finally got around to it. Yeah. I can't say that I'm glad that I read it because it's extremely depressing. But what's even more depressing is almost 100 years later, and I can't say that things have improved. Certainly not for the animals.
Well, there's certainly still lots of problems, but that's why there are organizations like the United States and others that are working hard for everything, for the animals, for public health, there are environmental implications of our diets,
We would certainly like to see something like this pass so that downer animals aren't included in the food supply. But even if it was passed, how are they enforced? Because there are a number of regulations already that aren't even enforced on a regular basis.
No, that's very true. In fact, the General Accounting Office recently did just basically lambasted the USDA's inspection service for allowing these drug residues in the meat. I mean, we have laws on the books saying that you have to withdraw certain antibiotics, certain drugs that can cause adverse reactions in people who are allergic for other reasons, and toxic levels of metals, all sorts of things. There's very specific withdrawal times for these drugs, but when you actually test the meat, you're finding these drug residues widely dispersed. The USDA is not recalling this meat even when they find the residues.
Mm-hmm.
And so you're absolutely right. But look, until we even have the laws on the books, that's the starting point. And then when our investigators or other investigators find the problem, then they can actually take action. Over it. I mean, that right now, if we go into a slaughter plant and see them dragging, down pigs to slaughter, there's nothing they can. I mean, there's no law. You can't
mm-hmm.
do that.
Right.
But look, if there was a law, at least they could be prosecuted. At least we could put an end to it on a case by case basis. But you're right. There really do need to be kind of wide ranging changes. And unfortunately, we're not seeing that with the current administration.
So just don't eat it. Don't eat meat. Don't eat meat.
Well, even regardless of what people choose to eat, I mean, these kind of factory farm practices can have implications regardless of what you eat. So, for example, half of downed pigs in this country have active viremia with swine flu.
I'm glad you brought that up. I was just going to talk about that.
So these are actively infected, half of pigs that are down, these so-called fatigue pigs. The 2009 swine flu pandemic killed 10,000 Americans. And arose, three-quarters of that virus, kind of the primary ancestor of that virus, came from this triple hybrid mutant virus that emerged about 20 years ago in Sampson County, North Carolina, from these kind of intensive confinement situations, and went on, and now thousands of people are dead. It doesn't matter what you were eating. I mean,
That's
it's
right.
these kind of these factory farming practices can infect people regardless. The manure can get on the broccoli.
That's right. All those innocent vegetables get.
So regardless, we all need, regardless of what we eat, we all need to kind of advocate for a healthier food system.
Okay, so the winter's coming. What do we do about the flu, and do we have anything to worry about?
So far, no. There hasn't been any concerning new viruses. Of course, that can change. I mean, that's the problem with influenza. Over the last 30 years now, there's been kind of the snowflake to an avalanche in terms of new, pig and chicken viruses emerging because of the intensification of production around the world. You know, when you confine tens of thousands of animals, you know, beak to beak or snout to snout, atop their own waste in these kind of filthy, stressful, unhygienic conditions, it's kind of a breeding ground, kind of the perfect storm environment for the emergence of these new highly pathogenic, highly disease-causing viruses, some of which can attain the ability of jumping to humans and then transmitting human to human, and thereby triggering a new pandemic, and so that's what we're most concerned about, and so we really need to give these animals a little breathing space, and really change the way we're raising animals the world over, not just here in the United States.
Yeah, unfortunately, it's growing at alarming rates in China and India and other third world countries.
That's true, and in part, is there kind of a reflection of us role modeling on this Western diet? And so we say, well, what can we do here to change what they're now eating in India? Well, look, we can change our eating habits, and maybe that will have this kind of cultural role modeling effect as well. Yeah, India, I think, is really one of the saddest stories where, traditionally, at least 40% of the population has been vegetarian. But now that, including, and eggs were considered not vegetarian. But now, unfortunately, egg consumption is going up. Mm. We're seeing diabetes rates skyrocket. Yep. And we're really seeing them kind of westernize their diet. And that's just going to be devastating to the country. I mean, imagine our healthcare costs translated to China or translated to India. It's a tough situation, but we have the cure.
That's right. We
have
it.
The cure. We can prevent these diseases. We can stop these diseases in their tracks, and we can reverse these diseases. But there isn't strong financial interests that are going to get this information out to the public. That's why it really has to be grassroots with great books like the China Study or Dr. Esselstyn's work. We really have to kind of teach each other to get this information out there, because we don't have the $10 million a day advertising budget that McDonald's has.
Do I need to get a flu shot?
The recommendation as to whether or not to get a flu shot depends on one.
I'm not getting one, but I just wondered.
Pre-existing medical conditions.
Mm-hmm.
But I would encourage people with respiratory ailments such as COPD, emphysema, etc., for which a bout of the flu could be potentially fatal, that even though the current seasonal flu vaccine it's not great, it probably only reduces your chances about 50%. You still get the flu, but for people who getting the flu could be potentially devastating, potentially serious, I would encourage them to get the flu, as well as healthcare practitioners, because we don't want to kill our patients any more than we already do.
Are we getting any more savvy nutritionally, especially when it comes to vegetarian diets? A lot of us know the favorite questions are, where do you get your protein? Where do you get your calcium? Are there more questions in the picture, or are those still like the top two most popular questions?
What do I get? Well, yeah, I get kind of, I think, some of the more kind of specialized questions just because of what I do. Most people off the street don't get the "what's the best type of mushroom again?" question.
Yeah.
I think there's certainly more kind of widespread acceptance. So, for example, these These kind of the flexitarianism, these Meatless Mondays campaigns. The American Meat Institute did a survey, and they claim that 20% of those that know about Meatless Mondays, which is about half the population, so 10% of the U.S. population is quote-unquote practicing Meatless Monday, which,
wow,
whatever that means, whether or not they're just reducing their meat consumption on Mondays or completely eliminating it. But, I mean, that's, I mean, you know, 1/7 fewer, you know, if one cares about animals, that's billions of animals,
yep,
saved. If people are just not eating meat one day a week, that's 15% less saturated fat intake in terms of these public health implications for heart disease and some of these other conditions. And so something like that, these things are really catching on in a real kind of wide population-wide kind of level that you really hadn't seen before. So I think there's more general acceptance, and so I think you know, there's certainly hope for the future.
There is hope. Say hallelujah. There are certainly, veganism is becoming more mainstream. More people are familiar with the term. We hear about it on television, on Dr. Oz and the doctors, and more talk shows mention it. It may not be in the most positive light, but it's getting out there, and that's good. But there are many different shades of vegan diets today, and some doctors and nutritionists are really passionate about their own, and others are passionate about theirs, and they're not all the same. Some are promoting no oil, some oil, some fats, some salt, no salt. Where do we go?
As always, we go to the science, right? We stick to the science. I mean, that's how we, you know, it's not perfect. There's certainly, you know, you have to find out who's, you know, funding various studies. But that's the best we have in terms of determining these kind of questions in terms of what we should be eating. And the science, I think, is pretty clear that one should try to eat a whole foods, plant-based diet, you know, with as many dark green leafy vegetables as they can possibly eat, and berries every day. Green tea would be a good idea every day for most people. B12 fortified whole foods, plant-based diet, including nuts and seeds, so these high-fat whole plant foods are remarkably healthy.
And yummy.
So the longest-running study on vegetarians in human history, for example, the California Seven-Day Adventist Study, found that those eating just an ounce of nuts three times a week or more could cut their risk of heart disease in half. So these are people who are already healthy, right? They're vegetarians. But those vegetarians eating nuts were even healthier, had lower heart disease rates, and significantly lower. It's data like that suggests that those people that tell people to stay away from whole food sources of fat haven't been biking to the National Library of Medicine as often as they should.
Thanksgiving is coming up, one of my favorite holidays. Do you know what you're going to be having for Thanksgiving this year?
Oh, absolutely. Well, here we're blessed to have the Poplar Spring Animal Sanctuary here, and so here in D.C., animal-friendly folks go have Thanksgiving with the turkeys, go feed pumpkins to the pigs, who go crazy. So there's always a big potluck every year, and so we're really looking forward to it. But on my own, I don't know. I'm a big smoothie fan, so I do my Thanksgiving pumpkin smoothies with frozen cranberries and lots of, you know, cloves and cinnamon and nutmeg, and we have these wonderful farmers markets give these little sugar pumpkins, and yum,
really, that sounds very good. I gotta try a pumpkin smoothie.
Oh, they're fantastic, and they're just so thick and luxurious.
Are you using fresh pumpkin or are you using
fresh
canned?
You can be a slacker.
Yeah.
And you get the canned pumpkin, but then you don't get to enjoy the post-smoothie roasted
seeds
snack.
Love
afterwards.
The seeds.
So, hey, right, great, yeah, source of zinc and all sorts of other wonderful minerals. Probably,
yes,
one of the healthiest seeds.
I've been having a great time with pumpkin seeds these days.
Great.
Any new recipes that have come your way? I know for a while you were always doing something new.
Yes, I always try to, I'm always trying to tweak things. You know, I come back from the library, my whole family is, oh, what do we got to eat now? Like, oh, wait a second, why is there parsley and everything all of a sudden? You know, because I try to live what I see, or at least when I'm not traveling and stuck in Arkansas somewhere and living off Taco Bell bean burritos or something. But,
no.
I know, it's very sad, but I haven't been doing much traveling. This website has taken over my life so much that I've had to pull back from my speaking, so I am able to eat healthy. Probably my latest favorite snack, and again, 'tis the season, is, the date harvest is in California. So I'm a big fan of, and so for people who either don't like dates or tried dates, and they don't realize that these old, dry, desiccated, that there are literally thousands of varieties of dates, and some just taste like caramel candy, and
incredible.
I encourage people to spread out, and this can be as easy as going to a local Middle Eastern or Indian spice store and taking a sampling of some of the dates there, and people be amazed. There's something called a peanut butter date. It actually tastes like peanut butter. There are Kodwari dates that taste like butterscotch. Mm. So I've been having a lot of fun experimenting. So basically I get some good local organic apples, cut them up, and eat them with the dates for kind of a caramel apple, sensation from my youth. That's been my latest craze. But, that's because it's 'tis the season, and, mango season's over, so I got to eat something.
Mango season where? Certainly not where you are.
Mango season anywhere, essentially, now. So the Mexico mango season, for example, is over. And so that's where most, I think, mangoes come from here in North America. And so we have to wait until, next March or April before good mangoes come rolling back.
You just mentioned when you were traveling and not finding much food to eat. I keep hearing about different areas and neighborhoods and places where people just don't have access to healthy food. What do we do about that?
Well, what they do, they get, frozen fruits and vegetables. I mean, if you look at my freezer, it's half frozen greens, half frozen berries. In many cases, frozen fruits and vegetables can even be healthier than what you find off store shelves, because what's been on the shelves has been sitting on a ship for a week, and it's been sitting there exposed to air, exposed to light. Fruits and vegetables frozen, maybe frozen actually the day they're picked, and actually retain more nutrition. And these are the kind of things, they last well. There's no excuse not to eat healthy, even in areas where you may not be able to find the best fresh produce.
That's really good to know, because all those supermarkets have frozen vegetables.
Right.
Pretty basic ones.
Right. Right.
Very, very good.
And cans of beans. You can get low-sodium beans. And, they basically last forever. You can get, canned, processed tomato products. And you can make, all sorts of, with just those few things, you can make all sorts of variety of kind of ethnic dishes, whether Italian or Mexican or, Indian, just by kind of switching up the spices. But, based around the same kind of things, quick cooking grains, whole grain pastas or, buckwheat or anything. And you can make these simple meals, don't have to go shopping all the time, with these non-perishable and healthy items.
You mentioned the spices, and you can flavor up foods very differently, but herbs and spices don't just offer up great flavor and variety. They've got some good magic in them, too.
Oh, they do. In fact, right, some of the most, in terms of by weight, probably the most antioxidant-packed foods on the planet are the herbs and spices. And in fact, many of the actual phytonutrients themselves, the flavor components, are actually the same phytonutrients that have these disease prevention and treatment benefits. And so we should not just eat colorful foods, but we should eat flavorful foods as well for optimum health.
How lovely is that? And how lovely is that? The foods that taste the best are the best for us.
That is true.
If you have a clean tongue that can
taste. The industry found a way to say, oh, you want brilliantly colored? Here's some Fruit Loops.
Right.
As a way of kind of fooling our biological brains that, you know, looks for those brightly colored, because the only thing natural that's brightly colored is all these really healthy things, like the berries and the fruits. But now they kind of can subvert those tastes, right? But
have there been anything in the news lately that's just been totally off base in terms of health? We're always hearing sound bites.
Oh, every day. I mean, there's just so much bad stuff out there, and you know, some of it is just poorly reported, doesn't adequately reflect what actually the science says. Some of the science is poorly done, either on purpose or not, depending on the funders. And so it just comes out with some really, counterintuitive or just plain wrong findings. Probably the most, the biggest thing to come out this week was the recommendation from our federal government as well as the American Academy of Pediatrics for children to start getting their cholesterol tested age 9 through 11. Used to be, we wouldn't start testing people routinely until their 30s.
Right.
But this is now, there's been kind of a big backlash kind of in the national food community saying, how dare you test kids that early, right? You can imagine the drug companies just salivating at the thought of getting people hooked on statins decades earlier
than they
normally would.
But why don't we hear from the government that, maybe testing is a good thing, but why can't they say, let's have our children stop eating cholesterol?
Yes. Well, see, that's the thing. It's not the testing. It's not the testing that's bad.
No,
and indeed, the diets of our children are so bad, we're seeing these epidemics of childhood obesity. And, you know, now we used to call it adult onset diabetes. Now we call it type 2 diabetes because it no longer just happens in adults anymore. And so, yes, this is a problem, and we shouldn't just cover up the problem, but the problem is, if they test and they find it, even though your cardiologist said that was first on their list, fruits and vegetables, it's easier for the doctor to just write a prescription.
That's right.
And many of these statin drugs aren't even approved for children that young. And
it's
so
scary.
It's not the test. I actually agree with the testing. Because we have such an epidemic, we want to start as early as possible. You know, these fatty streaks start very early. Atherosclerosis, heart disease, is a many decades disease process building up. So, yes, we have to start early, but with a healthy diet, not with drugs.
Amen. Thank you, Dr. Michael Greger. You are the best. Thank you so much for joining me on It's All About Food. Please check out nutritionfacts.org. You could spend a lifetime there. Thanks for joining me. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to It's All About Food. Thanks for listening. Please check out my website, responsibleeatingandliving.com. Have a delicious week.